plants in the desert are going to stab you one way or another, whether it's a cactus with the spines or a mesquite with the thorns or an acacia. There's definitely days where we're putting on, you know, the heavy duty long sleeve shirts before we go and do battle with, you know, a crown of thorns or something like that. Creosote is certainly the most common in a lot of these areas. I never know if it's appreciated or underappreciated, but right. That nice, you know, rain smell that we get in the desert is from creosote and some of the other plants that release these volatile aromatics.
I know that in Spanish, the creosote is gobernadora, and I'd always heard that it has that name because it doesn't allow things to grow around it? Is that what it is? Or
it does produce a chemical that can accumulate in the soil below it that can prevent other plants from growing. Bighorn sheep are button heads, but the plants can't do that. So the plants compete largely through chemical warfare. Growing out in the desert is really tough.
Welcome to the second edition of Desert Diaries. This is Daniel Carey Whalen with the Centennial Museum in Chihuahuan Desert Gardens. I'm with our guest, our botanical curator, Kevin Floyd of the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens. We're going to be talking today about the 25th anniversary of the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens, as well as the flora of the region. And I just wanted to start, let's just get right into it, Kevin. What are the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens?
So the gardens are the area basically surrounding the Centennial Museum. So it's the sort of side and back of it. And we've been around about 25 years now. So they were the creation of Wynn Anderson. He was the first curator and certainly the creator of the gardens, his vision. And he would be sure to tell you, with a lot of help. He had a lot of help from different people. Dr. Natalicio, the president at the time, was a big supporter of the gardens and really helped make it happen. But yeah, so he, you know, he was a geologist by training who fell in love with the plants of the Chihuahuan Desert and just wanted to be able to show people how beautiful they are, and have the gardens act as an educational location, both for, you know, UTEP and the community, for students to come in, for faculty, staff to enjoy them, but also for the broader community. Like, we're really trying to convince people that this is the kind of thing that we should all be trying to emulate in our own yards and in El Paso, that we can have, you know, beautiful landscapes, native plants, low water use, sort of all the benefits without, you know, just having rocks with a barrel cactus in the middle. And
right.
That's, you know, we don't have to have that as the stereotypical El Paso landscape.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And that's when I first came to El Paso and learned about the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens, that's what I had learned, that it was a demonstration garden. It was a way to show the public, here's what these plants could look like, kind of full grown plants. And so talk a little more about that idea of a demo garden.
So there's a couple areas to it. I think a lot of people do not know about all the different plants. Plants are always the sort of the least known or the least exciting, I think, part of the wild to people. You know, you want to see the birds, you want to see the mammals, and then the plants are just the thing that they're sitting on, right? You have to look through the plant to see the cool stuff.
Right.
And so we're really trying to, you know, show people that the plants in and of themselves are beautiful. And the demonstration part of it, some of the gardens initially were themed by, you know, this is what you could have in a patio. This is kind of, you know, a low water use. We have bunch grasses, blue gramma grass and buffalo grass, with some shrubs in the background. And so the idea is, you know, this could be your yard. If you want to have some grass, but you don't want it to be, you know, Bermuda that you have to mow, you know, every week and fertilize and all that stuff, here's another option for you.
Right.
And then some of the other beds were really designed to be representations of some of these different habitats within the desert. So we have plants that are found more in the mountains. And so we have an area called the Sierra Garden, and that's where some of those mountain plants are.
Right. Sure.
We have the Arroyo Garden. So, you know, it's got graythorn, which is this really great plant with 2-inch spines on it that you can find in the arroyos, and it's, you know, it doesn't look like much, but when it flowers, it has these little tiny flowers that wasps and bees are just attracted to like crazy. So
yeah,
so just these different areas that are sort of themed, and then other parts where we're really just, here are some cool plants. Here's some nice things you can look at, and like you said, see them a little bit more full size, see what they can look like. One of the challenges with a lot of native plants is that, you know, they've evolved to have deep roots. They've evolved to, you know, have conditions that they just don't look good in a pot. And so you go to the nursery and you're like, why am I buying this little sprig, this tiny little thing? And so, you know, the gardens are a way to show people, like, you do buy that little thing, but once you get it in the ground and it can kind of spread out and do its thing, now you've got this really impressive plant that can fit in your landscape really well.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, that there's so much potential to a lot of these plants. And yeah, you know, so I'm a, as you know, I'm a historian by training, so I often like to think of, well, what was it like in the past? Or what was it like 25 years ago, you know, 1999? And I remember before I even moved to El Paso, reading an article that, you know, like, okay, where's this place that I'm living, and reading that they, that the city of El Paso was paying people to rip out their yards, you know, their grass and you know, I think it was just that, right? It was just like, get rid of your grass, save water, right? And as we've talked about before, you know, it's like, what's the alternative? The alternative usually is just a bunch of gravel, right? Or rocks of some kind, which, as we know, is just going to increase the heat on your house. But that was kind of the alternative, is like, you could either do this or that. And I think that I just see Wynn Anderson, I see, you know, the people, you know, the community, because it was such a, as you said, it was a whole community that wanted this garden, was saying, well, no, there's a third way, right? And that third way is, let's bring these native plants into your garden. So you yes, get rid of the grass, but no, don't just put a bunch of rocks and a few cacti in the front. So I find that very fascinating, that it was definitely a time and a place, right, that this happened in.
Yeah, and we still are, you know, fighting those battles. I think there's still a lot of people that, you know, water is becoming more expensive. The water utilities does a great job of trying to find resources for us and find those other places, but the harder it is to find, the more expensive it becomes. And so people still want to rip out lawn if they still have it, or they just want to go with rock. They just want to get rid of everything. But like you said, the heat is there. It doesn't do anything to bring in the insects, to support any of the biodiversity that calls the desert home. And so, like you said, this is a really good third way where you can minimize your water use while still having, you know, a yard that is prettier than just rocks or paved. That's the other one, just concrete. It's like, your water is just running down the street, the heat is just radiating off of it, your electricity bill must be crazy, and it's like, it doesn't have to be that way.
And I think that, you know, having it be a demo garden, you know, really kind of showcasing, hey, you can do something else with your yard. But then, you know, and that was really surprising to me when we were doing the research for the Cultivating Your Home exhibit that's currently at the Centennial Museum, but that you know, that there was always from the very beginning this Wynn especially had, but everyone had this, like, love where you live, you know, that finding beauty in the desert, finding beauty in our home, that was always an intention of this garden, which I just found fascinating learning about this. But tell us more about that vision of the garden.
Yeah, so, you know, you can have a very low water use native plant garden that is also pretty ugly. And so one of the nice things that Wynn was able to do is to design something that is beautiful. It's aesthetically pleasing, and there's a lot of lessons in there that people can incorporate. So some of those really big adobe walls that we have help to block the wind. So that's a big issue with a lot of our yards. You know, they have to deal with the crazy winds that we get in the spring that dry out all the plants. And so, you know, you can use all sorts of things as wind barriers, but this is an option. So it also helps to, you know, keep the garden pretty quiet. You know, if you're in the gardens, there could be, you know, a bunch of students and other people walking along the outside, and you can hear them, but it's definitely some muted. Yeah, it's a much more sort of relaxing, peaceful place with some of those walls.
I think that's one of the neatest things about the Chihuahuan Desert Garden. I know that I'm constantly walking through and just seeing people in the gardens and enjoying just being out in nature and being away from it. And yeah, you can, you know, in the distance, you can hear the cars and the highway, but it's buffered and people are just, you know, students in between classes are hanging out, doing homework, just relaxing. It's just such a peaceful place. And I know we're trying to talk more about that, you know, this kind of sense, I think since the pandemic, right, that the sense of well-being people finding places of solace in their day, throughout their day. And I think the garden provides that. And I don't know how much, I mean, obviously it was thought out because of just the way the benches and the way it was designed, it was meant to be hung out in. So they must have been thinking about it back then too.
Yeah, you can't have, I mean, you could have a garden that doesn't include people and doesn't have any thoughts for people, but then you lose, you know, if people don't feel welcome, then they're not going to come through. So we try to make it a welcoming experience for the visitors.
Yeah. So what makes the Chihuahuan Desert Garden so unique?
So it's one of the few gardens that's really focused on a particular region. So we are the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens. We focus on plants from the Chihuahuan Desert, primarily northern Chihuahuan Desert, because it's what matches our, you know, climate the best. So it's the easiest for us to take care of. And so, again, we don't think that people understand the beauty of the desert. They don't understand the beauty of their home. So we're going to bring that. All together to be able to show people those plants. Yeah. The numbers, you know, we've got, you know, it's hard to say because plants come and go.
Right.
But we're probably around 600 species of plants and, you know, roughly an acre. So it's a pretty impressive amount of diversity packed into a pretty small place.
Yeah. It's pretty dense.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely are facing some struggles because of that. You know, we're starting to see, you know, over the past 25 years, the trees are bigger, the shrubs are bigger, things that, you know, were initially planted right next to each other are now competing, or in some cases have died because, you know, that's what happens in nature. There's competition for resources, and as much as we try to, you know, give the plants supplemental water and TLC, at some point, they just can't make it. And so it's definitely evolving, but is still, you know, full of really cool plants, and the trees. I think seeing the trees and shrubs at their full size is pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, it is. I love, you know, especially in the autumn, you know, there's changing colors of leaves and which trees are dropping their leaves. It's fun to see. And yeah, I forget every time I go out, you know, when I'm visiting another city and I go to another botanical garden, I forget how unique we are in that, you know, I go someplace and I think, the last one was in San Antonio, their botanical garden, amazing botanical garden. And I think, oh, I'm going to see stuff that's native to San Antonio. Well, no, I'm seeing stuff from all over the world. And that's cool in some regards. You know, I enjoy that. And the way it's curated, right, that idea of kind of putting these plants, oh, this is the species from South America or whatever, you know. But forgetting that we're unique and it's not just, you know, what you can see in our garden, you can be grown in the rest of the community, right?
Right.
And I guess you could do that in San Antonio, maybe have some exotic South American mm-hmm. plant in your yard, but it'd probably take a lot of water and a lot of resources, right? But here we have these things that pretty much everything you see in our garden could probably be grown in your yard with minimal, you know, once it gets established, with minimal time and energy and money.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty low tech. We've got, you know, a couple part-time gardeners, but you know, we do cover some stuff in the winter. Everything's on irrigation, but you know, we don't have hothouses. We don't have stuff we're moving inside during the winter, and some of the issues are the things that other botanical gardens are able to do because they do have that mission of, you know, showcasing by, you know, plants across the world. We don't have space or really interest. We really love the Chihuahuan Desert, and we keep it focused here.
Yeah. Well, so tell us about some of the plants, some of the things that that people will see in the garden.
So there's 600. So this is going to be quite the list. You know, it's like choosing your favorite kid, right?
Right.
So some of the ones that I think people are always attracted to are the cacti. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, the Chihuahuan Desert is known for a huge diversity of cactus, and we have a really nice cactus collection.
Right.
Somewhere probably around 30 to 40 species. The cactus garden, it's pretty sort of all the time, but most of our cacti tend to flower sort of late spring. So April to May is definitely peak. There's Texas rainbow, New Mexico rainbow, Turk's cap cactus or eagle's claw. We have several types of prickly pear that start to flower a little bit later.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons people find cactus so impressive is that they're flowers are huge relative to the size of the plant, or at least
right.
a lot of them are. You can
right.
have a, you know, a plant the size of a ping pong ball with a flower also the size of a ping pong ball.
Right.
Like, they can be really, really impressive. And they're just so otherworldly, you know. There's no leaves. There's just these little green mounds with spikes. I think people really like that.
Yeah. Well, and then the flowers are not only are they large relative to the size of the rest of the plant, but then that they're so vibrant. A lot of times, you know, super just these otherworldly. I like that word, that a vibrant, really pink or yellow. It's pretty amazing. And I feel like, you know, when I first moved here, I remember running into someone who kind of described himself, you know, and he was kind of saying people from the borderlands, you know, here are like these cacti, that they're kind of tough, resilient, right? The spikes, right? That he was a resilient person, you know, but yet also this beauty that just comes out just a certain time of the year, right? You know, I always love April, late April, early May, to going out there because there's always something new flowering. And so, to see, you know, and that's what he was saying, was that there's also, you know, people are resilient, but then have these moments of beauty as well. And I love that description.
Yeah, I think I agree with all that. We have a lot of our plants. I mean, we always joke that, you know, plants in the desert are going to stab you one way or another, whether it's a cactus with the spines or a mesquite with the thorns or an acacia. It's always exciting to find a plant that doesn't have spines or thorns or something on it.
Yeah.
There's definitely days where we're putting on, you know, the heavy duty long sleeve shirts before we go and do battle with, you know, a crown of thorns or something like that in the garden. But we also, you know, speaking of crown of thorns, we have a lot of really interesting shrubs. The Chihuahuan Desert, sort of the scrubland of it, is known as, you know, a shrubby desert. So creosote is certainly the most common in a lot of these areas. There's also mesquite, and we've got both of those. Creosote, you know, it's, I feel like I never know if it's appreciated or underappreciated, but right. You know, it's common in the desert, but then people love to have it in their yards because it doesn't need a lot of water, has beautiful yellow flowers throughout the season, and contributes to that smell. So that nice, you know, rain smell that we get in the desert is from creosote and some of the other plants that release these volatile aromatics with the rain. So, you know, I think a lot of people want to have that, you know, in their yard so they can enjoy that themselves.
I know that in Spanish, the creosote is gobernadora, and I'd always heard that it doesn't, in part, it has that name because of the, you know, that you see it everywhere, right? But then also that it doesn't allow things to grow around it. Is that what it is? Or
there's some debate in some areas, so that it does produce a chemical that can accumulate in the soil below it that can prevent other plants from growing. I think it typically, like, that's more of an issue in the really dry areas where that chemical can accumulate and not be washed out. And a lot of plants do that. I mean, the things that we think about, you know, plants are also competing for resources, right. And, you know, bighorn sheep are button heads, but the plants can't do that. So the plants compete largely through chemical warfare. So they'll produce chemicals that keep other plants from growing underneath them. But the other part around here, a lot of times you find plants growing underneath creosote. So if you look for cacti or you look for some of the shrubs, because growing out in the desert is really tough. It is hot and dry and windy. And so a lot of seeds will germinate in that sort of the better environment that you see underneath the creosote.
A little bit of shade.
Yeah. The term is nurse plant. And so there's a lot of shrubs that act as, you know, nurseries or nurseries that help the younger plants establish. And then, you know, sometimes they don't make it because the adult plant can outcompete them. But then other times, you know, that adult plant dies. And then, you know, the things that were growing underneath it are able to sort of take off and grow more.
There's two plants that I know a lot of people in the desert think about, especially, you know, our connection to Mexico. There's the agave and the sotol. And we'll talk about the agave first, I think, because agave, amazing plant, tons of different species in the Chihuahuan Desert, all over Mexico. But people are familiar with it in part because it produces mezcal and tequila are the two most famous drinks, but all sorts of other drinks as well. But talk a little about the agave.
Yeah, so agaves, like you said, there's a lot of different species. Here in the Franklins, the two that are the most common are the lechuguilla, sometimes called shindagger, which if you go hiking, you know exactly why it's called shindagger. Uh-huh. And then there's one that's called the New Mexico agave. It's a little bit larger agave. And agaves are pretty much all of them. There might be a couple exceptions across, you know, the whole group, but they only flower once in their life. And so up until that point, that plant is just gathering resources. So it's going through photosynthesis, it's making sugars, and it's storing those sugars in the heart of the plant. And then eventually it has enough resources built up, and it could be 10 years, 20 years, depends on the conditions in the plant. And then it sends up that big flower stalk and puts all those resources, all of that accumulated sugar gets converted into a flower stalk that will grow. You know, we just this year had our Weber agave flower. It was a plant. Yeah, it's a plant that's like 6 feet tall, and it sent up probably like a 30-foot flower stalk in a month. I mean, you think about like a tree trying to grow 30 feet. It takes it years, and this just all those resources, and then the plant just withered because that was it. That was its sort of big shot at reproduction, and it produces these flowers. A lot of agaves are pollinated by bats. Not so much in our region. There's maybe a couple that make it in here, but in other deserts and other parts of the Chihuahuan Desert, there's
the Big Bend area.
Yeah, Big Bend has nectar feeding bats. And so, you know, an important resource, but that stored sugar is also what allowed people to use it. So, you know, the way that you harvest agave for making tequila or mezcal, you cut off all those leaves and you get just the heart of the plant, the piña or pineapple, and roast it. And then that roasting basically releases the sugars or caramelizes the sugars. Then you press that out and then ferment that. And so that basically that tequila or mezcal is representing, you know, years of photosynthesis turned into sugar that we then ferment and enjoy on a weekend or Friday night. Yeah.
Well, I know that, talking to someone about who was, familiar with the process of making tequila was saying that, when do you, now it's all commercial, there's farms where they're growing them and maintaining them, watching them, but they're making sure to cut them down at a certain time, and it's before they, spend all their energy making right. that flower stock, right? And so, it's like you've got to harvest it right at the right time while all the sugars and energy is in the heart of it.
And then, and Sotal is basically the same story. So right. It's a different, different plant, different species. Mm-hmm. Also really common in our area. They have spines along the leaves, or serrated, grabby margins that'll cut you. So you'll definitely see those out in the desert.
Yeah, it's like a saw almost.
Yeah. And they also store sugar in the heart, but unlike the agaves, they can flower, multiple times and still survive. So in a good environment, maybe they flower every year. If it's not so great, maybe it's every other year or something like that. But again, it's a really important plant, both for the, making Sotal, the drink out of it, but also those fibers in the leaves, people can peel those and make those into sandals traditionally, or baskets, all sorts of function to them.
Yeah.
And with the agaves, like all those leaves that have those sort of parallel fibers in them, you can basically peel them apart, and there you go. That's your way of making a blanket or something like that.
Rope. Yeah. The ethnobotanical, and I know we're going to get into some of that in a future episode, but just fascinating the uses that humans have done with plants and agaves and the fibers, like you said, are, weaving, different types of mats and sandals, very strong fibers. And then, the drink Sotal seems to be kind of catching on lately. I mean, I feel like it's kind of a newer drink. I know that, kind of like tequila, where there definitely has to be made in Mexico and Jalisco and these certain areas of Mexico. That I've heard that the state of Chihuahua is trying to kind of formalize the industry more to say this is definitely that it has to be made in Mexico to be called Sotal, and that it they're wanting it to be certain places in the state of Chihuahua. So, both have the stalks. I remember first moving here, seeing the lechuguilla and the Sotal stalks, being really fascinated by, wow, what are the, I mean, so crazy. But when you look at the bottom of the agave lechuguilla, for example, was all over the Franklin Mountains, and you just see, usually it's like autumn time when I'm trying to think when they're.
Yeah, I think like typically late summer.
Yeah, summer they're blooming and they're dying off, and seeing the dead agave at the base of it, unlike the Sotal, which some plants I see just in my neighborhood that have 2 or 3 years, it looks like, of stalks that are that have since passed.
Right.
But amazing to see, especially Sotal, when it's blooming, I'll see bees insects all over. I mean, they're just digging on the Sotal flower.
Yeah, just crazy amounts of pollinators on it. And then afterwards, when those stalks are dried out, bees will nest in it and other insects will nest in it. So, carpenter bees, and you can sometimes, get a stalk and sort of open it up and see different nest cavities of all the different insects in it.
Wow.
So at the gardens, we try to never throw those away. We end up stacking them on top of the roof at the little wall as part of the wall garden. That way, it's available for the bees to use. And if there were bees already in it, we're not, chopping them up and sending them to the landfill.
Right, right. Well, that's why there's so many carpenter bees in around that part of the garden.
They like to, and they're sort of territorial. So when you walk by, sometimes they'll buzz you.
Yeah, buzz, but not sting, right? They're not a stinging bee.
They can be, but they don't. I mean, they're not typically aggressive. So you're pretty safe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about some other unique plants in this area?
So one of the things that I think people often ask about are like, what are some good trees that people can plant, some good native trees? And it is tricky. I mean, that kind of gets to the discussion of what is native. So, you know, if you're in the river valley, willows, cottonwoods, those were the native plants. But right. You can't grow, it would be really hard to grow those on the east side where you don't have the water resource. They're really water intensive. They need a lot of water.
And the sandy soil.
And the sandy soil, yeah. And so, you know, the things that can be pruned as trees. So it's kind of interesting, like mesquite. So the same mesquite that you see if you're out by the airport or on the east side where it's just a mound with some sand piled up around it, that's the same mesquite that you can turn into a tree if you give it extra water and prune it the right way.
Right.
And same with like desert willow, which is another really great tree. We have, you know, two that are probably 30 years old in front of the
right.
museum, and
yeah.
they're 50 feet tall, 40
yeah.
feet tall.
Amazing.
And that's the same thing. That's a little, you know, 6-foot shrub in an arroyo. So you can take some of these plants and, you know, take them out of the sort of wild, harsh conditions and give them a little bit more water and pruning, and there's your native tree. So desert willows are great for that. They flower, you know, almost the entire summer. Insects love them. Big flowers, right? It's that, like, how is that a desert flower? They look like orchids. So those are really nice. But then if you're, you know, sort of go up in the mountains a little bit, you can find some really cool oak trees. The Chihuahuan Desert is home to the biggest diversity of oaks in North America. There's tons of species, and like almost every mountain range seems to have its own specific type of oak. So we have one called the Chisos Red Oak, which you can guess where that's from. It's from the Chisos Basin in Big Bend and the Davis Mountains in those areas. And they, you know, because they're higher elevation, sometimes, you know, they may not do well in a super dry environment. They will need some extra water. But the ones we have in the garden have grown really well and are beautiful.
Yeah.
They have beautiful fall colors.
Yeah,
good shade tree. That's another thing that people are looking for a lot. And a lot of our desert plants want to be shrubs, so it's hard to train them up enough to be a shade tree. But the oaks have sort of that traditional, or at least the Chisos Red Oak has that traditional form that you can, you know, turn into a shade tree in your front yard or your backyard.
Yeah, I love that Chisos Red Oak, especially in it starts turning colors in November, like, you know, late November, beautiful red leaf. But I often think about it because especially when we're, you know, like last episode we talked about native, what is a native plant, but it's from the Chisos Mountains. It's from the Big Bend area, Davis Mountains, right? It grows at a higher elevation, but it can grow here. It grows in our garden quite well. It could grow in someone else's yard, depending on where they live, maybe closer to the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Could grow well there, but it wouldn't necessarily be native to this area, right? It was brought here by humans.
Right.
But it thrives. It is a Chihuahuan Desert species, and if you give it the right conditions, the soil and kind of probably elevation, that you can see it. You could see something like that thrive. And so I think it's just a good example of something that might not be found immediately in this area, but, you know, it works well in the garden kind of like where it's at. Well, it's west, northwest side, so it probably gets a little more shade than other spots. It does well in the garden because of that.
Yeah, it gets afternoon sun, but is protected in the morning a little bit from the morning sun, which is kind of unfortunate. Morning sun is always the best because it's not as hot. So, you know, it's handling a lot of heat. So I think it's a good plant for the area. And just thinking, you know, it's even though it, you know, the Chisos Red Oak in particular is not something you would find in the Franklin Mountains, it's still more native than something that you would find in, you know, Florida or in Wisconsin, like where some of the other oaks are. So it might like a little bit more water than what we typically get just through rainfall, but it's not 50 inches of rain a year like something from the East Coast would want.
Another plant I wanted to talk about, we mentioned last episode, the green of the mountains in the monsoon season. And a lot of that, I think, comes from the Ocotillo plant, just the vibrant green of this otherwise very strange and spiky plant. But we have a few of them in the garden, I feel like.
Yeah, Ocotillo are one of the like great examples of how plants have adapted to living in the desert. So Ocotillos, they look like a single, you know, stalk or a bunch of them if they're together, sort of, I guess, almost grassy in a way. And in the spring, they have bright red flowers on the top. And a lot of hummingbirds have actually evolved to time their migration with the Ocotillo. So they show up into this area as they're coming from the south at the same time that the Ocotillo are flowering. And it's, you know, this really important relationship. And then the Ocotillo, you know, if we don't have good rains, those leaves will turn yellow and dry up and they'll drop off, because a lot of the ways that plants lose water is through the leaf. Yeah. And so you don't have leaves, you don't lose the water. And it just sort of sits there as a stick, a very spiky stick, until we get rain again. And then it can grow leaves out really quickly. So use that water resource while it exists, yeah. Photosynthesize, get those that energy. And then if it doesn't rain anymore, drop those leaves again. Nice. And so it's just really sort of an interesting thing to consider, where it's better energetically in water for it to like grow and drop and grow and drop than it is to like lose that water or try to maintain those leaves like throughout the season.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, one of the things that I like about Ocotillo is I almost think it could be our version of the Chihuahuan Desert, this region's version of the saguaro, that we, you know, I see it in art, you know. People are often kind of painting it. I know it's an inspiration. I was talking to some of the engineers. I can't remember who it was that did the campus transformation at UTEP. So when we did redid the center of campus, that those light poles that surround the big circle of the Centennial Plaza that were inspired by the Ocotillo. Yeah. And so I feel like it's an emblematic species that that inspires El Paso and inspires people from here. But also, while we were doing research for the exhibit, you were talking about how it's often being taken from Texas land and shipped to, you know, the Sonoran Desert, and people are using it in landscaping there, but that people are harvesting it here in Texas and bringing it over there.
Yeah, it's kind of a slow-growing plant, so you can grow them from seed, but it takes a while. Right. And so instead, people basically can dig them out of their property. So I think in a lot of cases, it's totally legal. It's a, you know, somebody's property, and they, you know, either they dig them up or they allow someone to come in and dig them up and, you know, strap them onto a trailer and take them to, you know, a population center. Could be here, could be Tucson, Phoenix, wherever. But it is one of the big ones. It's taken one of the major species. It's taken from the Chihuahuan Desert and two other locations. The Ocotillo does grow in the Sonoran Desert, so it does grow in those areas. But I think, okay, you know, Texas, with the sort of you can do what you want with your land, just makes it easier for, you know, the harvest to come from here. Yeah. Which is too bad. I mean, those plants are representing, you know, decades of growth. And a lot of times, you know, a lot of these plants are tough and they can survive that kind of bare root, drying out, manhandling, you know, rough conditions. But not all of them are going to make it. Right. So right. It's one of the things, you know, we try to grow them from seed, try to make sure you're getting them from people who are growing them from seed, or at least, you know, harvesting sustainably. They're not just going out and grabbing everything out of the desert.
Yeah, yeah. One other plant I'd like to talk about, and I know we see it a lot, there's many varieties, but the yucca, I feel like it's, you know, pretty well known. People see it. I see it always on the highway, you know, and it has a pretty amazing bloom on it in the earlier spring, I think.
Yeah, most of those are early spring.
Yeah.
They're often confused with agaves and sotal. They're kind of in that same group of, you know, kind of long, spiky leaves. yuccas tend not to have, you know, the spines along the leaves like the agaves and sotal can. Often they're very pokey on the end. And we have, I think, at least three species common in our area. The soap tree yucca that likes a little bit more sandy soil. It has very thin leaves and can grow pretty tall and can have multiple heads that flower. The tory yucca is the really tall one that you would see in the Franklins. And then there's banana yucca, where the fruits are actually big and I guess reminded someone of a banana. Right. And those tend to be a little bit more low-growing and spreading. And yeah, we've got three. They're more like the sotal. They'll flower multiple years, so they don't have to just flower once and die like the agaves do. But yeah, they have typically white, creamy flowers on big flower stalks, and when they're blooming, it's an amazing sight to see.
Yeah. Well, that banana yucca, I know our friend Alex Maris and Joey Padilla, who's a mescalero, I know they're always asking us about are the banana yucca producing fruit? So they're looking for them. I know so indigenous folks obviously have a connection with the tree and the fruit, but they said lately it's been hard to find. I think just because the drought, I guess that. Yeah. That it's they're not a lot of plants producing the fruit.
Yeah, that's interesting. We don't see fruits in the garden very often, and I typically attribute it to us not having the pollinator that they need. Yuccas have a very specific relationship with a group of moths called yucca moths, and they, you know, they're these white little moths that blend in perfectly into the flowers. And I won't say that I've looked for them very hard in the gardens, but I haven't seen them in the area. And I don't know if it's, you know, we're just too surrounded by suburbia and the city to have that species in the area. Yeah. Because I will see, you know, banana yuccas with fruits in the Franklins or the Tory, any of the yuccas. And then in the gardens, we don't seem to be having that occur, even though, you know, we're watering, we're taking care of the plants better than they're getting out in nature.
Right.
So it's a good example, you know, potentially of this connection between the plant and the pollinator. If the pollinator's not around, that plant's not going to be able to set fruit and won't be able to reproduce with seeds anyway going forward.
Right.
Well, yeah, and I think, that points to another, you know, kind of purpose of the Chihuahuan Desert gardens is that it's to create one of these habitats, right, that we have this little oasis in the middle of the city. I mean, it's pretty urban around the university. I think it's changed with the campus transformation that UTEP did a couple years ago, that we brought in more native plants around the campus, but it's really an oasis in the middle of the city. And I like to think that as we're, you know, that other mission of the garden of getting people to put, you know, plant more native plants in their gardens, is that we're creating these little micro environments that might be at least creating a little chain of microclimates that are allowing animals and insects and birds and to live.
Yeah, we often think about it sort of as like a stepping stone model. So, you know, the gardens are part of it, the campus more broadly. You know, my yard with native plants provide a place for, you know, the insects and the birds to stop by. Other yards that have similar areas, so they can kind of, you know, hopefully the vision is that they can hop from one good habitat to the other, and those yards that are just rock or just grass that don't have those other resources, you know, they can basically make it across a city through all these little patches of native habitat.
Well, Kevin, I appreciate the conversation as always, talking about native plants, Chihuahuan Desert Garden. We're going to wrap up this edition of Desert Diaries. We look forward to everyone joining us to celebrate life in the Chihuahuan Desert. We'll see you next time here on the Desert Diaries. And this is Daniel Carey Whalen with the Centennial Museum in Chihuahuan Desert Gardens.
Desert Diaries is recorded in the KTEP Public Media Studios and is a production of the University of Texas at El Paso Division of Marketing and Communications. Host is Daniel Carey Whalen, producer is Charles Fench, engineering by Paul Castro.
I look forward to seeing everyone or hear.
So close.
Let's try that again.